Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
This is episode 16 of The Living Reminders with Mary and Blake.
2% doesn't sound like much. But 2% of the entire planet, of every person on it, that's more than the world's 10 largest cities combined. It's 140 million people. And like that, they were gone.
All the way from Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to The Living Reminders with Mary and Blake. It's a podcast dedicated to the leftovers on HBO. We're still here and so are you. So let's talk to Christopher Eccleston.
Suddenly I'm hidden. It's the darkness of the dawn. When your friends are gone, when your friends won't come, so show me where you fit. So show me where you fit.
I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My name's Blake, and suddenly, I want to play some roulette.
I sure don't.
I want to go throw the dice.
Oh, my goodness. I do not have good luck.
Maybe try my luck. Hey, save a church. Get some money.
Hey, you could
Anybody?
Try.
No, nothing.
We know how that works out. It doesn't.
Not so much.
Well, everyone, welcome back. This is part two of our three-part Emmy series interviews.
Yes, and today, like we said, we have Christopher Eccleston for you, who we all know as the Reverend Matt Jameson. And I must tell you, we've already recorded this interview, and what Christopher Eccleston says in this interview is...
You said serendipitous in the last episode
when you teased it. Yeah, but it's so serendipitous that it's like, whoa, time out. Like, wow.
Yeah.
I'm just going to leave it at that. I'm not going to go any further. I'm not going to go crazy with it, but... Wow, I can't wait. So, you know what? Let's just get right into the Eccleston interview. What do you say, kid?
Sounds perfect.
All right, let's do it.
Joining us now is Christopher Eccleston, an extremely accomplished actor who has starred in numerous film and television projects, such as Thor, The Dark World, The Others, G.I. Joe, The Rise of the Cobra. I always feel like I need to sing, G.I. Joe, Heroes, Elizabeth, Gone in 60 Seconds, 28 Days Later. He was so creepy in that one. And Doctor Who. But we all know him as Matt Jameson, the lovable and deeply conflicted Episcopal Reverend on our favorite HBO show, The Leftovers. Chris, thank you so much for joining us on The Living Reminders today.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
My first question for you is, how did you hear about The Leftovers, and what was the casting process like?
My great friend, Julian Farino, who's a British director, who's responsible for a number of HBO shows, Entourage, How to Make It in America. He's a real bookworm, and he handed the novel to me and said, I've heard that HBO are going to adapt this. Do you want to read it? And we're forever passing fiction to each other. So I read the book on my summer holiday, actually. And I loved the book. And for some reason, I genuinely connected with Matt Jameson, who, of course, in the book, has probably a page, appears for about a page. So when I was duly offered to self-tape for it, I told them that I wanted to be considered for Matt Jameson. I sent the tape in, and then I met Damon in London, who was there in London publicizing Star Trek. And I've since learned that he was very intrigued that I picked out Matt Jameson because he has such a small role in the novel. But he and Tom had already decided that Matt Jameson was going to feature a little more heavily. But of course, what I understood is that if you have an Episcopalian preacher who is at the center of what is possibly a biblical rapture, and he has not been taken, you have a very potent, dramatic figure or character or device, if you like. So after the meeting, they cast me as Matt Jameson.
There was, as you said, about one page about this character in the book. So what kind of research did you have to do to fully grasp the role of being a reverend?
We shot in New York, and I visited a couple of churches and simply sat at the back of services and observed. And also I did some reading about Episcopalian religion, about religion in America generally. But more, you know, most importantly, I relied on my first instinctive reaction to the man, because despite his religious calling, he is, of course, a man. So I relied on Tom's book and the imagination and material that was offered to me by principally Damon Lindelof and Jacqueline Hoyt, who I think has thus far been, along with Damon, the key writer for Matt.
After you got offered the role, did you know a lot about Matt going into it, or did you just get drip-fed the information about Matt?
It was a very instinctive and trusting instinct on my part. And the meeting with Damon was key, because in the meeting with Damon, I detected that he felt what I felt, which was this was a very rich, dramatic character. And I felt he would take care of Matt, which means he would take care of me. And I left it at that. I shot the pilot, in which I think I had two lines. and then turned up when we were picked up and did a line in episode one and had a line in episode two, and then had that monster episode in episode three. I just go with the process, really. I like feel that just what goes on when these shows are working correctly is that in some mysterious way, the writers tune in to where the actors can take the character, and sometimes predict certain things that are going on in the actor's life. It's a very strange relationship, I think. There's been a lot of coincidence, and I'm not a person who particularly dwells on that side of things, you know. But there's been a number of things on this show which have been interesting coincidences. For instance, when I shot the pilot, I had an affinity with Carrie Coon. I remember I was compelled to hand her a book. I'm sure she thought I was a nutcase. when we were shooting the pilot, I gave her a book, a brilliant novel called Stoner by John Williams. But I had a kind of affinity with her, and we talked, and we had no idea that we would end up playing brother and sister, but there was some kind of connection. And I had the similar feeling with Anne Dowd, although Anne and myself have not really featured together, but particularly myself and Anne have become very close friends, and me and Carrie are playing out this brother-sister relationship, which I always longed for a younger sibling, and I always longed for a sister, because I was the baby of the family, and now I have this fantastic and complicated brother-sister relationship to play with. And I know Carrie's far more beautiful than I could ever dream of being, but I think there is a kind of, in the ballpark, of a physical resemblance. You know, I can see it. And it was a strange coincidence.
Did you spend any off time with Carrie to help build that brother-sister relationship?
It was there. It was just there.
Wow.
And what I mean by that is we had a simpatico with each other, because the relationship actually between Matt and Nora is hugely complex and sparky and competitive and volatile. We don't have, fortunately, me and Carrie don't have that kind of a relationship. But we have the trust, which means that we can portray that relationship. It's a very odd, you know, it just kind of fits.
When did you find out that you were actually going to play her brother? And was it almost like a sense of relief?
I don't know about a sense of relief. I think it probably was to feel... I think it was a brilliant stroke, really, on the part of Damon and Tom to have Matt Jameson, who is the eternal kind of outsider, but connect him to the community in a flesh and blood way. But the first time I was aware of it was when I was handed episode 2, because the pilot stood as episode 1. Neither Carrie nor me had any idea we were brother and sister when we shot the pilot.
What do you think it was that drove Matt to spread inflammatory statements about all the people who disappeared? And do you think he's representative of the dark place that everyone can possibly go to after a tragedy like this?
You know, when you're playing a character, you can justify the things that they do. What Matt was saying is I do not believe he had a personal animus against those individuals, even though they included, you know, murderers, psychopaths, pedophiles, etc. I think Matt, for personal reasons, was not convinced that this was an act of God. He could not, at that time, understand that God would choose such people. Now, maybe that was a failing in his faith, and all these questions for me are unanswered and will remain unanswered, because it's the mystery of faith. I don't think he was wishing to hurt people. He was wishing to help and unite people, and he was... You know, we were living in a world in series 1 where religion had virtually been abandoned. The idea of God, the Christian God perhaps that Matt represented, had fallen by the wayside. And what Matt was doing, as provocative and dangerous and deeply wounding as it was he was trying to get his flock back together. On a good day, he's a good man, and on a bad day, he's a bad man, like most of us, I think.
Well, speaking of that, over time, Matt's church does seem to grow. Do you think this is because he's an effective leader, or is it because people's faith is renewed?
Wow, these are hard questions.
I hope you had coffee today. I know, I'm sorry. Look at us.
all surrounding faith. I mean, it's interesting because Matt, I think, demonstrates himself, as all church leaders are, is a pretty formidable politician, a wielder of power. And of course, in series 1, when he identifies that the guilty remnants are controversial, he leads a charge against them. And the reason he does that is to get his flock back together. Now, that's politics. Mm. That is politics.
So we have him in two boats and a helicopter, eventually losing his church and actually falling prey almost to the guilty remnant. And by the way, that episode was transcendent. I believe you did an unbelievable job. I think it set The Leftovers on the course of the greatness that it is.
Well, it was beautifully written.
It was great.
Damon Lindelof, yeah.
So, but in this episode, we have this scene where Matt is driving to the casino and the traffic light suddenly changes to red and then it starts flashing red and it seems so symbolic. You know, do you feel the same way about this? And if so, what's your take on it?
Listen, this has gone out on a podcast. I always take notice of red lights. I promise you, America. I don't exist the way Matt does or was at that time. I think his openness to symbolism, to a sense of God speaking to him, came from two places. I think he was very close to a nervous breakdown because of the trauma of the rapture itself, of the implication that God did not want him, of the loss of his flock, and most of all, of course, the extraordinary grief at witnessing the accident and the subsequent condition of his beloved Mary. I think he was in a highly sensitized, highly traumatized place. And I think he was in a form of grief, and I think the red lights and stuff like that, you have to justify it three-dimensionally as a human being. And I think it was a form of magical thinking, which I think is very common in profound grief. That's how I lived with it. That's how I worked with it. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And that actually leads up to a follow-up question that I have, which would be, do you think he felt guilt about after the accident and then the state in which his wife was left?
Yes. Yes, I think survivor guilt is a huge factor for a number of characters, for all of the Leftovers. It defines them all in very different ways. I think as a society, I think survivor guilt I think it's a huge thing for Matt. And as a religious man who has the idea of, he very much has the idea of sacrifice and self-sacrifice and, being a figure of who absorbs the suffering of others. To have his wife that way is hugely confusing and disorientating to him.
Another big scene was when Matt went gambling, and I didn't know if Matt crossed a line by gambling the money in roulette, and is that ultimate failure of losing his church what pushes him to embrace love?
I think he was operating on the idea of two boats and a helicopter. You know, God sent him the money and God sent him the casino, so he went into the casino and gambled. Is that an answer? I sent you a boat, I sent you a helicopter. You know the joke of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know all that.
Yep.
I think he was operating on that. Whether Matt has embraced love, I can't say. I think he remains a very ambiguous and very confused man. I think he's very confused in a good way, and in a wrestle with his own faith and his own sense of self. I can't really say exactly where he is, and I don't think I ever will be, or will ever want to be able to say that. There are no definites. I know that about my own life, so I hope that's an answer.
Well, can you talk about that? You know, at least in the first season, he does seem to have a transition from where he was, spreading these really awful things about people to wanting to help the guilty remnant and save them. And can you talk about that transition in Matt's character over the course of the first season and what it was like to go from one extreme to the other for you?
Well, it's the kind of journey you long for as an actor. He has a series of revelations, and I do remember that Damon and Keith Griffin Gordon said to me, we have to end this episode paradoxically on a note of hope, because Matt sees his path in those last moments when he sees the guilty remnant taking over his church. He does not go crazy and burn them down. He uses a different method. He is, and I think this is leading to your next question, he does equate himself with Job and comes to the belief, realization, understanding that God has chosen him to suffer in order to find enlightenment, in order to lead. I think he comes to that revelation during the course of that episode and identifies very fiercely with Job.
So with that in mind, then, there was this great scene towards the end of the season, where Kevin is giving Patty's eulogy, and Justin Theroux was reading it, and it was gorgeous. Well, could you amplify on that Job passage in particular, and what that means to Matt, and what was Matt's motivation for having Kevin read that particular eulogy?
I'm going to be very honest here now. Job was something that I read. I had a very odd, this was the second odd experience with the leftovers. In 2011, it was the anniversary of the publication of the King James translation of the Bible. And I was asked, along with a number of actors, to go to Westminster Abbey in London in the middle of the night and read at various stations throughout the cathedral sections from the Bible. And I was given Job. And I'd never read Job, and it hit me like a truck. I realized he was the first existentialist man, if you like. Mm-hmm. He was saying he was absorbing this enormous amount of suffering and then steps up to God and says, why me? Which is basically saying, why am I alive? He questions. And of course, there's that extraordinary chapter where God turns on him and says, who are you? I am the creator of the sea. From an intellectual and from a dramatic point of view, it had a huge impact on me reading that. I read it in front of the ex-Archbishop of London, who on the completion of my reading just arched his eyebrow and twinkled at me, as though he'd realized that because I've played Hamlet, and then you read Job and you think there's a connection here. And then 12 months later, I was in a tiny, tiny church in Cornwall, England, with my mother. We were the only two people in the church. It was 10 o'clock in the morning. We were walking around this medieval church. The Bible was open at the page in the pulpit. I just walked over for fun, and it was open at Job. Wow. And I read it out. And my mum said, oh, you read that before? I said, well, I've read it before. And then 12 months later, I'm playing a man who is completely identifying and completely obsessed with Job. So I can't tell you, I probably wouldn't want to share with you or the audience all his feelings about Job, because I'd want to, hopefully, without being pretentious, convey that in the performance. There has to be some mystery.
Mm-hmm.
But the Job of the Bible and Matt's relationship to the Job is deeply complex. And hugely stimulated for me and Jacqueline and Damon and everybody to think about. And hopefully, of course, the viewers.
It sounds serendipitous that you got this role. I mean, would you agree with that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's what I mean, yeah. And I don't believe in all that, stuff. but I'm becoming more open to it. Where Matt is in his life, very different from mine. I have children. I'm happily married. Matt's happily married, but of course, has this great tragedy. But his passion and his drive and his indomitable spirit, he's not gone down. I see him as heroic and brave and flawed. And I do have a connection with the character that I've not really felt before in my career. And that sounds like publicity baloney, but it's just the case, I have ideas about him and where he is and poetry that he might like and that come out of nowhere. But that's also to do with the process that we're going through and we're led by Damon and by Justin. You know, there's a real freedom in the way we all work together and make this program, and it allows for that kind of stuff.
Actually, my next question, I guess, for you is then, how much freedom do you have within the character? Are you allowed to improvise in any way? Do you have input on what your character should do?
No, I come from a school where you honor the script. It's very important to me that I do that and the actors around me do it. I feel actors are not writers. Writers work should be honored and should be delivered as written. That's how I work, particularly on this show. I'm really strong about that. That was my training. You know, I trained on Shakespeare and Ibsen and Miller and Williams and Chekhov, and it was all about respect for writers. I came through British television, which is very writer-led, and certainly was it when I was a child and absorbing it. So that's my thing. I try to avoid contacting Damon because he's so bombarded. I think sometimes for us actors it's difficult because we do have ideas. And you've got to be very careful because, you know, you're not begging for a storyline. You know, in an ensemble piece like this, you know, it's a very delicate thing. But sometimes you may have something that you want to communicate because you're so emotionally involved in it. But what you find, and this is what I spoke to you about at the beginning of the conversation, is our writers, Damon, have intuited that kind of stuff. There is a communication going on a level that, you know, is very interesting. You know, I might say to Damon X, Y, or Z, and he'd go, we kind of thought of that. For instance, Anne Dowd once bought me a gift from a flea market in New York as a token of our friendship, because we are very close. Now, the gift was a small and very beautifully carved wooden Christ whose arm was broken. Now, Anne was buying it. One of his arms was broken off. Anne was buying it for Chris as a gift. But what she was also doing was sending a message from Patty Levin to Matt Jameson. And I was so stunned by this image and its relevance to Matt and his broken life and his broken church that I told Damon about it. I sent him a picture. I didn't do it in a really kind of, you know, hey man, let's trip out. I thought it was funny as well. I sent him the picture. And he was stunned because that day he had been discussing whether or not Patty Levin, in some ambiguous way, should send Matt Jameson a piece of his church. So, I know this sounds nuts, but that kind of thing. In the end, that wasn't written. But that's the kind of thing that goes on. Has gone on. So, I'm not saying it's mystical. I just think it's people involved in a creative process, thinking very deeply about the characters, and sometimes, quite often, crossing over.
I'm getting chills.
Do I sound like an absolute maniac here? Because I'm not. I'm only drinking orange juice.
All I know is Max Richter needs to start working in some Twilight Zone theme music
into his
score. It's unbelievable, and it just adds such another interesting level to this already beautiful story. And
it's remarkable. With that in mind, did you as characters, Matt and Patty, offset or when you're not shooting, did you ever feel like they informed each other? I know you just gave the story about the Christ with the broken arm. Was there any other things like that happening on set?
Well, no. Of course, the beauty of it is that I honestly feel myself and Anne, we talk about having been, you know, having met in a previous life. And of course, Patty Levin and Matt Jameson could not be more diametrically opposed, personally or philosophically. And it basically hates each other's guts. And me and Anne are the complete opposite, you know. There's a real closeness. I don't know what that says. And we've only had one exchange. We look at each other once. At the end of episode 3, we just look at each other. We don't speak. Obviously, she doesn't speak. We look at each other. And only last night, over a couple of vodkas, I was saying to Anna, I just wish we had a little bit more to do, you know. But what we do have is this friendship.
Did you know when you read the script for Two Boats and a Helicopter that it was going to be the brilliance that it did? Like, did you have an idea that people were going to respond to it the way that they did?
No, I had no idea what I was letting myself in for. I just had an instinct that this was an interesting character. I wanted very much to work for HBO. It had always been a lifetime ambition of mine. And I loved Tom Perez's novel. And I trusted Damon, his intelligence and his decency. And I thought, well, I'm an experienced actor. You know, I think it was clear that from myself and Damon's meeting that this was a character that was going to feature in some way. And I was shooting episode 1 and 2, and it was a rumor, basically. Somebody said, we've seen the story outline for episode 3. It's all about you. And that was the first I heard about it. And then they sent me a script, and we set to work. Had about 10 days prep. And the one thing I do want to say, and want to come out loud and clear on this podcast, is the importance of Keith Gordon to the creation of Matt Jameson. First it was Tom Peronto, then it was Jacqueline Hoyt and Damon Lindelof, and then it was Keith Gordon, because the way he directed me on that episode, and that's the other odd experience. There's the third one, I'll give it you. When I was 17, I went to a cinema in Walkden, which is the place that I grew up in, Salford. I was 17 years of age. I went to see a film called Christine. I was vaguely thinking about what I was going to do because I'd failed as a footballer. And I saw this performance by an actor called Keith Gordon in a film called Christine, where he plays a character who's completely outside, completely passive, a nerd, if you like, who then through this dark night of the soul becomes a psychopath and a murderer and yet retains our sympathy. And I remember thinking, that's one of the best performances I've ever seen. And if I become an actor, that's the kind of actor I want to be. And then who directs me in The Leftovers but that actor?
Wow.
Very strange, again. And Keith really, really was huge for me on that episode. His direction of actors, having been an actor, and his way as a man and as a professional is just beautiful. He was loved by the crew. And what I find now is whenever I pick up a script and I've got dialogue with Matt Jameson, I think, what would Keith say? Because he was forever pushing me away from any obvious choices, anything. He was forever looking for the little boy in Matt. The generosity, the vulnerability. There's a lot of anger there. There's a lot of, you know, he smashes a guy's head on the floor. Keith Gordon continually challenged my choices and stimulated me and took care of me. He meant so much in you know, nobody else could have directed that episode the way he did. He's wonderful, and he's coming back, which is great news.
Oh, it is fantastic. Well, as tough as Matt had it, he did have this beautiful scene with the baptism. And I want to know what it was like to film that scene, and if it was as beautiful in real life as it was on the screen, because we were silent watching it.
It was absolutely wonderful. But the actor who played the father of that child was so brilliant. I'd seen him in Scorsese's film, Wolf of Wall Street. And I just remember thinking how brilliantly he was cast and how brilliantly he played the scene. So we had that. And then we had that child. And of course, I'm an old dad, you know. I'd just become a father in the previous January. And also, no, I had a 2-year-old and a 3-month-old child, 5-month-old child. So, and I was missing them. They were back in the UK. Mm. So that was all going on. Of course, you bring a child onto a set and it affects everybody. Yes, it was a beautiful experience, that. Beautiful. That's all I can say about it. and working with that wonderful actor, two wonderful actors, because the baby, and we had no, obviously we had a couple of babies, and but there was no tears, there was no screaming. It was just they picked up the gentleness around them, and no children were harmed in the filming of the leftovers.
Not even the one in the car.
No, I promise.
Do you think that was like a cathartic experience for Matt? Finally, somebody coming to him and yeah, asking his favor?
Yes, and absolutely it was. And holding that child and softened him somewhat, I think. Mm. And there is, of course, that I always felt that that's one of the mysteries and things around Matt and Mary, is that they are a childless couple. Before the accident that befalls them, and all that was going on as well, I think probably Matt, probably like me again, longs to be a father. He is a father of sorts. Mm-hmm. He's very paternal with his sister, and I think it's it wired into Matt in that way. He's very rich. You know, all the scenes with Matt are rich. There's always a lot going on because Matt is very conscious in many ways because of his faith. He's forever analysing the things that happen to him and processing and looking at them in a number of ways. He's enlightened. He's blind in some ways. We know that. I know that. But he's also enlightened and conscious. So things are always very rich for Matt in symbolism and meaning.
What do you think is his biggest blind spot that you mentioned?
I don't want to say. I it's very difficult for me to condemn and judge him, and mm-hmm. I think that's for the audience to decide. Mm-hmm. I just have to play it. I'm not being clever here. I just feel that you've got to keep some stuff back, so the audience will tell me where to go with him. That's what I believe. You know, the writers will. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what my own blind spot is, so I couldn't tell you what Matt said.
Can you amplify on Matt and Kevin's relationship, and what do you think makes it so different and so personal for them?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of mystery there that we're still waiting to find out, because obviously I had some friendship connection with his father, with Kevin's father, and what I invented for myself there, that as his father became unstable, that I, to a certain extent, assumed the paternal role in his life, which then elicited the sympathy which Kevin exhibits at the beginning of my episodes. You know, Kevin's the only one who really looks out for Matt. He visits him in casualty, says, "Why do you keep doing this?" There's a sympathy and an empathy in Matt's madness from Kevin. There's a connection. It's a human connection. I think Kevin recognizes that Matt is struggling to understand this thing in the way that he is also. I think it's that. But I think there is going to be narrative stuff probably revealed about my connection to his father, which I simply don't know about at this time. Mm-hmm. I simply don't know.
A little bit of a hypothetical question. If you were to go through the departure tragedy in real life, like let's say it happened today, would you choose Faith the way that Matt did, or something like The Guilty Remnant? Or would you be like the rest of Mapleton and try to move on and whistle past the graveyard in a way?
I would be like the rest of Mapleton. I hope and I aspire to be like the rest of Mapleton, but who knows? The trauma of that, mm-hmm. my children, my wife, I was left, they disappeared. Who knows? I'd go mad, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. I would hope that I would be like the rest of Mapleton, the rest of humanity, but whether I'd end up in some extreme cult, it's impossible to say.
Well, thank you so much, Chris, once again for taking the time to talk with us on the Living Reminders podcast. This was such a treat, and we really appreciate your taking the time to answer these questions. We had a blast coming up with them, and just such a great time listening to you answer them.
Thank you very much.
A very special thank you to Christopher Eccleston and HBO, and also friend of the show Brian for help with our questions.
I know I teased it like heck, and I get it, but can you believe all the things that happened with him, like the Book of Job, and the Christ cross with the broken arm, and the actor who was his director?
I can't even handle it.
It's almost, like I said, it's almost creepy.
Almost. I don't even know the right word. As I said, I don't know if creepy is the word I would use. Yep. Just really interesting.
And what it took for him to get into that role. And also having that relationship with Patty or Ann Dowd.
Yes.
But his character... And Ann Dowd's character together, like I said, giving him that cross. It's unbelievable to know that these actors take their roles so seriously that they're almost acting when they're not even acting.
Of course. That's exactly it.
They're doing things within the story. And to know that, good friend of the show, Damon Lindelof, he gives them the freedom to do what they need to do, but also tells them exactly what he needs. It seems like a perfect synergistic relationship with all of the cast.
Comes out that way for sure.
I know, right? But again, for him to talk about all these things, and I like how we kind of stumped him on a couple of questions too. I thought that was kind of cool. His role in what he did with Matt Jameson was so important to the show. As important as Ann Dowd was to Patty, I think Matt Jameson was as equally as important.
I would agree. And for me, of course, I haven't read the book. And to hear that he was such a minor character in the book.
Yeah, only a page or two of actual text.
Yes. And now we get to see him as such an integral character this past season. This was an absolute treat. Mm-hmm. So, well, just in case you guys wanted more from The Living Reminders, don't you worry. Don't you worry.
You're getting more.
Coming up on part three of our Emmy series, we get to interview Carrie Coon,
who we all know as the beautiful and wonderful Nora Durst. And I cannot wait to ask her about Guest. And I cannot wait to ask her about that, spoiler alert, scene when she finds her family and in the finale.
Oh, I can't even watch it. It makes me cry.
And then also that entire reading of hers, that monologue at the end of the finale.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. And just knowing that she was in Gone Girl, and she was like unbelievable in Gone Girl, knowing that. And she's really come into her own as an actress.
She really has.
So it's going to be a real honor and pleasure to speak with her.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait.
What do you say? Can you want to close up the show?
You bet.
All right, let's do it.
Thank you all so much once again for listening to this episode of The Living Reminders with Marian Blake. If you want to hear any of our other episodes or get to know us or get to find out how you can reach out to us, please visit our website. It's thelivingreminders.com. Now, we are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. All of our handles on those social media outlets are just...
Platforms. Yeah. I'll take that
platform.
Word, too.
I like that, too.
Platform sounds a little bit more serious.
It does. You can find us. We are just... Living Reminders. So Living Reminders, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, reach out to us. Let us know what you think about this episode, this interview, maybe what you thought about the Ann Dowd interview, and especially what you're excited about for listening for Carrie Coon.
Oh my God, I know. And also, if you want to reach us on the email machine, you can get us at livingreminders@gmail.com.
Now, don't forget, you are going to want to make sure that you are subscribed in iTunes and Stitcher. You want to make sure that all of these episodes are coming straight to your mobile device. And once the second season comes too, I mean, heck, we're going to be pumping it out.
All of our recap and analysis is going to be right there waiting for you, just you, ready to experience the greatness that Damon Lindelof has to offer us.
So please, make sure you subscribe. Make sure you stay in contact, because we would love to hear what you think.
Hey, what do you think, by the way, of the new music? Do you like the new close-up music? I forgot to mention that last episode.
I do. It's haunting. It's beautiful. Max Richter. I mean...
You can't get much better than
you
that.
You can't. You can't. Listen to this.
It's gorgeous.
It's fantastic. Well, for now, I'm Mary.
My name's Blake.
And we're still here.